Episode 2. Where is the magic? What is it that magic does? What is its agency? Within most work of Western European fantasy, such as The Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, or even Macbeth, magic can help to advance the plot, often providing power to heroes or to their opponents. It happens by giving characters, objects, or environment powers that do not naturally occur in the real world. To make sense of it, Brandon Sanderson, an American author of epic fantasy and science fiction, popularized the terms hard magic and soft magic systems. Hard magic is a magic system with specific rules and regulation. The magic is controlled and explained to the reader in the narrative, detailing the mechanics behind the way the magic works and can be used for building interesting worlds that revolve around the magic system. A soft magic system is usually much more vague and undefined, with a mysterious aspect to it. They provide limited exposition regarding their workings and are used to create a sense of wonder to the reader. Here are the transcription of conversation I had with my parents. The first one with my dad, who grew up in Gelma, and the other from my mom, who is from Constantin. Both share again with me stories they grew up with. The type of system used in the following stories tend more to the soft magic side, more vague and concentrated on feelings and not logic. Its goal is to provoke a sense of power and awe. It is not aiming to be a deus ex machina to solve a problem in the story, but it is here to empower the theme of said story. Stories from my parents. Do you remember the stories I used to tell you? It was your granddad who told me these most of the time. It was their life experiences at the beginning of the 20th century, and there was a magic supernatural side. A typical example would be, well, your granddad had a brother. He actually had many, but this one was quite poor compared to the others. The other weren't rich, but were comfortable. But him, in everything he was undertaking, it didn't work. He was broke. The evening of what we call Azerda, it is a celebration to the memory of a saint, a marabout. As it happens, it was Sidi Ammar. So we party, we make food, we invite people to honor this saint. So the poor uncle, during this event, goes to the mausoleum to speak to Sidi Ammar. You've been there, right? Have you seen it? Yes, yes, in Ain Berda, I said. Exactly. So up there, he starts crying and asks, why do I have nothing compared to my brothers? I do everything right in the normal course of things. Because, you know, it is also part of the celebration. You go in there and you make duas, wishes. You can sleep inside the mausoleum if you're a close relative. When I was a kid, I slept there too. Otherwise, people sleep in the court next to it. The celebration lasts for 3 days and 3 nights, with music, prayers, shooting rifles in the air, all to honor the saint. So after the event, the uncle takes his donkey to go home. When I say home, it was like a shelter with thatch and earth, a gourbi. He lived in the brousse, deeper in the mountains, and on the road, he met an old man, but like bedridden old, that he never saw before. It is a place where there should be no one. So he stops and gets down from his donkey and asks him, "Wesh el Hajj, did you get lost?" He helps the old man to get up, and the old man answers, "I got lost because of you, but since you were brave," and then proceeded to spit on the uncle's face and said to him like this in a vulgar manner, "The black cow, she shit on you." By the time he wiped himself off, the old man was gone. This uncle became one of the biggest landholders of the area in less than 3 months. He only had his donkey and a few black cows. He managed to raise a herd. It was the beginning of the well-being of the family in general as peasants. This kind of story were told then during evening, mostly by the women, when they did bocales also. Mama told me, Allah yarhamha, she said to me, there was a guy who was very, 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 very poor who lived in Constantine, who had a wife and children. And then he heard about a haunted house in Algiers. Because it seemed that this house, that all the people went to sleep there, well, the next day they were found dead. So he said to himself, since I'm dying of misery, I'm going to go to this house with my family so we all die. So he takes his family and he goes to Algiers. He asks people, where's the house? Are you crazy? You're not going to go there. All the people who were there are dead. But he said to them, it's none of your business. I want to. I'm going to go with my family and my children. And so he goes. He's going to spend the night there. And when the night comes, when he's put the children to sleep, he sees a black man coming into the house, a giant. So he said to himself, that's it. He's going to kill us. But the giant said to him, hey, well, I've been waiting for a while for you to come with your family. The other people who come, they die, because this is your house. It is for you with everything that's in it. And that giant there was, if you will, the keeper of the house that no one else saw. And then they lived there with the children. In the old houses, the Arab houses, when you walk into a room, there's a kind of compartment, but it's not blocked. There's a little door and people put it there, you know, like people put in butter or honey so it doesn't spoil, for example, because it's cool in these rooms. And so one day it was two women who lived in this room. They lived in that room, and one day they were making berkoukes, you know, araish, like couscous but bigger grains. They were doing it in the house, and they heard over there in the little corner over there under the thing, two voices saying, can you believe it? They are doing araish. They are not even giving us a little. So once they're done, one of the ladies takes a plate, fills it with araish, covers it with a napkin, and puts it like that at the entrance of the compartment. It's a bit like a cold room, if you want, compared to the rest of the house, which is hot. So she put the plates over there, and there was no door, there was just a little curtain. So she put it on and they go about their business. And then in the evening, they were there after eating, both of them seated. And they see the plate they had set, which comes out slowly under the curtain. They go to see and they remove the towel. And guess what they find? Pearls. They gave them back pearls. And that's why, if you want, we know that there are people like that who gulu salhain. That is to say, good people that we do not see and who do good. And there are also people among them who do no good. It's like humans. There was a lady in the towns before, you know, the old towns. Because the European towns, they were outside. But the town, the old town, the Arab town with big houses, the Moorish houses as people call them, beautiful houses with interior courtyard, etc. And there was a lady who was like the midwife that everyone knew because she was the one who was going to deliver all the pregnant women at home. And one day she hears, it was almost dark, and she hears a knock on the door. They say to her, you come, there is a lady, she's not well at all. You have to come to give birth to her. And so she put on her veil and follows them. She goes, she goes, she goes. And you saw in Constantine when we are on the bridges, do you see downstairs where there is the Rummel? At the very bottom, the rocks at the bottom of the ravine, she follows them there. She follows them, she follows them, she follows the guy, and they go there, and they go down, and they go down, and she finds herself at the bottom of the ravine, and she said to herself, my God, what's going to happen to me? But she didn't say anything. So she goes, and she gives birth to the lady. The baby is in good health. And you know, before, women like that who helped give birth, they didn't ask to be paid. We gave them food, we brought them clothes, a beautiful gandora, etc. And when it's time to come home for her, do you know what they're giving her? A bucket full of coal. And she goes home and she said to herself, my God, you gave me some charcoal. What am I going to do with it? And all the way down the road, she was throwing like that, a lump of coal, a lump of coal. And she got home and there was one lump of coal left in the bottom of the bucket. And what does she find? A piece of gold. But too late, she had been had. When we were told that, we were waiting for the punchline. And when she told me that, I asked my grandmother, didn't she retrace her steps? But she told me, do you think people who pass by are going to leave the gold? What exactly are the tools of storytelling? So one could argue that the structure of the story, how the story is set up, the tonality, the voice of the narrator, the pattern, repetition, the musicality can be considered the tools of storytelling. Academics' account on Shawiya storytelling are again a big absentee. Therefore, I will base my analysis on my parents' stories and on the analysis of Mena B. Lafkiwi and Daniela Merola in Conte Berber Shawi de Lores d'après Gustave Mercier, who used the few colonial collection of Shawiya stories. An interesting part of it is the phonetic in itself. As with other Zenati speeches, Tashawit has for one of its main characteristics a principle of the least effort. This translates, for example, to deleting the first vowel or the last consonant, fus, instead of afus, the hand, afuk, instead of tafukt, the sun, lafkiwi. But since the collection of my parents' story were in French, I would put more attention on the narration structure. In the stories, we can see a certain pattern that we can essentialize as follows. Events presented as true, a gone past with a different social situation than today, early 20th century, there does are still in practice, a specific place, the Heinberda Mausoleum. If we take the first story as an example, the magical help the uncle got has set up the morality that venerating the ancestor and acting right will bring you enough to live a decent life. On my mother's stories, we can see a slightly different structure with an undetermined past, the old houses, the old town, and a continuity with the present. A common thread is the themes explored, financial difficulties, and the respect of the spirit world. This is probably due to the time where my parents grew up in the 1950s, which was for many indigenous people an extremely difficult and traumatizing period, with the war and its horrors at its highest, and therefore an extreme misery for the most. Usage during and after the independence war in Algeria. Taught in the language of the colonizer, a Mazir writer, Keteb Yassine, considered the French language the Algerian spoils of the war for independence. He declared in 1966 that la francophonie is a neo-colonial political machine which only perpetuates our alienation. But the usage of the French language does not mean that one is an agent of a foreign power, and I write in French to tell the French that I am not French. Trilingual Keteb Yassine also wrote and supervised the translation of his text into the Amazigh language. His work manifests in his multicultural country's search for identity and the aspiration of its people. His work is known for reinventing surrealism, but I see it as an intention to draw close from the traditional storytelling, his work functioning as an oeuvre, with recurrent characters and non-linear and often changing time frame. Lounes Matoub was a musician and activist of the Amazigh identity cause in Algeria and made his contribution in the claim of popularization of Amazigh culture. Tackling different themes, he is however best known outside Kabylia for his committed songs, often catalogued as violent by Algerian journalists, and songs that Westerners would qualify as protest songs. On June 25th, 1998, Matou Blounès was assassinated on the road leading from Tizi Ouzou to Azdouala in Kabylia, a few kilometers from his native village. The condition of this murder have never been clarified. The singer's funeral brought together hundreds of thousands of people, while the entire region experienced several weeks of riots. His latest album, Lettre Ouverte O, released a few weeks after the assassination, contains a parody of the Algerian national anthem in which he denounces the ruling power. On his way of composing and structuring music, he said, "I never studied music or harmony. Even at galas, I have no sheet of music, no lectern, nothing. I have always worked by ear, and I acquired this musical ear by listening to the elders, by attending funeral vigils, where the songs are absolutely superb, real liturgical chords. But we don't think about God there. We talk about social misery, life, death. These are songs from our heritage that generations of men and women have sung. It is my only musical culture. Apart from that, I admit being unable to read a single note of music, to the point that I cannot distinguish on a score my own compositions." Cheb Hasni did not sing strictly political texts, but in the fact that he freely broached taboo subjects, such as sexual relations, he necessarily put himself in the open on a field mined by censorship. So to put it short, to transmit knowledge, a soft magic system is infused into a storytelling with a theme and sometimes moral. By telling these stories from generation to generation, a resilient ways of transmitting knowledge is created, and through the edges, give place for a person to put themselves within society and the universe. By doing this, it opens a huge area of relations between realities and representation through time and space.